Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. I hope you are well. I am here in sunny Liverpool. Well, it's not that sunny, actually. And in fact, I have a massive fire drill happening in my apartment block. So this is going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. Hope you're well this morning. And yeah, welcome.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good morning, all. I hope you are well. This morning, it's Thursday, what are we on? The 5th of August already? Is that 3 weeks of the holiday, Dan? I'm not liking that. This morning, I am discussing, all sorts, actually. But first on the kind of agenda is Latin and bricklaying and apprenticeships and everything in between. And I'm joined by Karen Bales, who is joining me now. Karen, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm okay, getting used to a new bit of technology by calling into this.
Yeah, happy days. Thanks so much for taking the time out to call in today. It's much appreciated. Now, let me make sure that I get your kind of bio correct. Your an NEU national executive and the chair of the NP and YW National Council. You're going to have to help me with that one. And Officer for Unity as well. Do you want to help me with NP and YP? YW?
Oh, it's the New Professionals and Young Workers. So
thank you.
It's looking at organising and the issues around people that are new to profession. Although I am currently outgoing, there'll be somebody else chairing it at the start of September.
Got you. So you're heavily involved in the NEU, by all accounts. Now, interestingly, as we know, there's been a lot of... I put a tweet out, I think it was last week, after seeing the stories about Latin coming into kind of key stage three. I think this is something that, obviously, Gavin Williamson is really keen on. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, for a start, I don't know about you, but I've got quite a few friends that already teach Latin in state schools for the GCSE. There's a GCSE in it already.
I know a few, but I think the idea is to introduce it much more widely. I think that's the idea from Mr. Williamson. Yeah.
So it's starting off with about 40 schools, isn't it? £4 million funding. So it feels more like a headline grabber than a serious attempt at trying to introduce Latin, isn't it? Like, if you're going to where are we going to get the teachers from? Was my very first thought.
Quite, and you know, I think when I tweeted out, when I discussed it on Twitter, there were actually, I mean, there do seem to be a fair number of classics teachers knocking around. And, you know, I think one of the key arguments with it is that you can transfer some of the language acquisition elements of Latin, and that supports learning other foreign languages. I suppose the counter argument to that would be, well, yeah, but we've got a shortage of, Spanish, French and German teachers. So why don't we just focus more on that rather than Latin? I mean, what do you think about those arguments?
Well, I think that's a very valid argument to make. The time when we start teaching languages in the United Kingdom, when we start teaching MFL at like the age of 11, if you look at any other country, all of my friends that are from foreign countries who are English as a second speaker, they're fantastic, but they all started at around the age of 5. If we want to be serious about languages, then we need to be looking at primary school rather than secondary school?
Yes. I mean, do you think that... I mean, I suppose ultimately it comes down to preference, doesn't it, in some ways, in terms of, like, you know, you've got these, you've got a box of language subjects, you've got a box of things that students can learn. And I guess then it comes down to a choice in terms of what they do. I mean, do you think when it comes to Latin, there is a certain element of this is high challenge, so therefore it's something that we want in this kind of new age, in this new curriculum era? Is there some element of that in terms of, you know, this is a traditional subject, it's very high challenge, and it's attractive to some schools in terms of in those respects? I mean, do you think that's what attracts some of them, or do you think it goes further than that? I mean, what is the Latin attraction, if you like?
I think it's one of those things where I think it is a matter of perception, isn't it? So from my point of view, it almost kind of feeds back into like the class system, isn't it? So where a lot of private schools, a lot of people in senior positions in this country have all learned Latin, it's something that they do. So therefore, it almost goes back into that whole idea of cultural capital, doesn't it? So therefore, Latin is a key part of cultural capital within certain echelons of society. So therefore, if you wish to join these echelons, then you need to be imitating what they're doing. I think that's kind of like the principle behind it. Because if we want to think about like rigor and challenge, any subject can have rigor and challenge, isn't it? It's down to where the curriculum and the course and how the teacher presents that to the students. Every subject can have a very high challenge.
Absolutely. I think there is a perception that some subjects are more challenging than others, and usually they are of the academic ilk. And there has been that sidelining of the arts. And one thing that I've argued quite rigorously is the idea that art, you know, there's this weird thing of like, oh, art isn't as challenging as, it isn't as, I don't know, as high end or whatever as something like, I don't know, maths. But actually, art is just as technical. It's just as complex. It's just as valuable. I mean, when you think about the future and you think about the things that are going to have even financial value, then art, drama, things of this ilk, I mean, they're the things that we export the most of out of this country is theatre, arts, TV, movies, all kinds of literature. You know, these are the things we export. So it's an interesting concept that we're almost, I don't know, I wonder whether, I know the counter argument to that is about kind of, yeah, but it's not about future jobs, it's not about future prosperity, it's just about learning, it's about the joy of learning, it's about knowledge acquisition, it's about wisdom. Do you understand what I mean? And then you've got like those two lines of thinking, and it's kind of like, I think often it's the kind of, oh, you know, it's the knowledge side of it that wins often now. I don't know whether it's always been like that. I don't know what you think about that, but just those.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, isn't it? When we talk about our kind of like private schools and the kind of curriculums that they offer, there's a lot of attention paid on the academic, but like, they're fantastic facilities for support. They really do support creative subjects as well. Various friends that work and family members that work at some of the top private schools, like they offer a tremendously broad curriculum, and they really do appreciate that kind of those creative subjects as well. They provide the resources, they provide the time, you've got to wonder if there's got to be a massive benefit to having such a broad curriculum, the ability to develop confidence in a variety of different skills, both skill-based and academic. I think that's really what whenever we have these kind of discussions, we always end up with being pulled into quite a narrow perception of of perceptions of what our education system should be. And it's really looking more a kind of like a joined up approach, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my tweet that I put out last week about kind of bricklaying and this idea that, you know, I think my question was, is why isn't something like bricklaying much more prevalent and prominent in schools? And there was a range of responses. I mean, a lot of people pointed out funding. But then equally, we could say, well, Latin is now looks like it's going to get a batch of funding. You know, other subjects get funding. There's a lot of CPD funding. And there does seem to be that lack of appreciation of things like bricklaying, electronics, plumbing, other things that will lead directly to jobs. There is an avenue there, and also very well paid jobs. You know, I mean, do you think this comes down? What is the reason we don't have more of this happening?
I think funding and resources is an issue. I also think there's an element of time as well. If you consider that we've seen a reduction in PPA time for a lot of teaching staff, that we're seeing ever increasing workload from outside the classroom. When we ran a course, a bricklaying like building course in our school, it was quite labour intensive to try and get everything together because we had to rely on. We, you know, external assessors need to come in. We needed to get specialist trainers to come in. We then looked into developing apprenticeship routes with local employers and small local businesses. And all of that takes quite a lot of backroom organisation and time as well, which frankly we neither had the time or the money for. And there's also space. We had a whole separate terrapin set up so that you can have enough room to do this. It's the same with the technology department in the school I'm working at. It's had to be scaled back simply because we don't have enough room after having to increase our size of our year groups a few years ago.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people pointed out is that if you were to, I mean, one of my ideas was that you would have like a bricklaying teacher who was actually like in the school, right? Or a, you know, whatever, you know, could be a plumber, whatever, somebody with that expertise. And then there would be like a set area outside, like maybe undercover somewhere, where they could do this, or like an empty, I don't know, an empty whatever, like a empty classroom, but just not even a classroom, you know, just like an area, basically. I think one of the issues that people flagged up was the money that somebody would have to, like, for example, if you were to get an electrician or a plumber or whatever to kind of come in on a part-time or full-time basis into a school, you'd have to pay them more than what they earn outside, which under most school budgets, it's going to be impossible. But then equally, do we need to reimagine school budgets? Do we need to start thinking, right, okay, hang on a minute. This money and time that we're putting into X could be better put into Y, you know, and the Y being this kind of investment in this, would we call it an apprenticeship route within school? Or, I mean, they're talking about cancelling BTECs, you know, I don't know. I don't really know the backstory to that. Do you? The whole BTEC issue. I mean, again, that I think they're saying they're going to amalgamate BTECs in under some other umbrella.
Well, we've kind of seen the erosion of BTECs for quite a while. If you think back, we used to have quite a few vocational BTECs that were worth like 3 or 4 GCSEs in total, and were quite extensive in what they demanded of students, and. My students that did those kind of routes, they all did secure, most of them did secure very good apprenticeships at the end of it. And those were removed. The valuations of more than one GCSE equivalency. So it's kind of a route we've been going down for quite a long time. And I think when we're looking at this, it's quite useful to look at what's been going on in our sixth form colleges and FE institutions. They've had a similar kind of issue with the ongoing attempts to roll out the T levels, haven't they? So there's been multiple consultations. There's been a lot of disagreement with what the government's been doing there. And those are the kind of routes and skill-based that we'd need to link these kind of vocational BTECs into, really, because it's not just thinking about what we're doing, it's where do they go with the qualifications once we've taught them.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you not think there is like a clear pathway though with, you know, the likes of bricklaying and plumbing and electronics? There seems to be a much more clear pathway with that than some other pathways. You know, like there's almost a pathway straight into employment. At 18.
There generally is, although what we found, it's going to be interesting to see the impact of the pandemic. So for instance, we like the leaving school member of staff that we've got that deals with a lot of the non university route students, we're having real difficulties at the moment getting apprenticeships for our students. I think there's a backlog from last year as well, so there's more.
That surprises
more
me. That surprises
more demand,
me.
But we've seen a massive drop off of supply as well. I think it may be because some companies have kind of had to scale back for various reasons.
Yeah, right.
And so we need to make so really the government need to be thinking about how are we going to make sure that those apprenticeships, that those employers are capable of taking on new trainees? How do we come out of the pandemic providing all the opportunities that we did have in my area beforehand?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the whole, one thing, this is slightly off topic, but I don't like the whole like, oh, bricklaying is this kind of element that we've had of, oh, if it's a student with, you know, who's struggling, let's say, with managing being in a classroom behavior-wise or whatever, oh, they're going to go and do bricklaying. Like, it's something that's not worth as much as something else. And I think that's something that we maybe also have struggled with, this idea, again, that bricklaying is less valuable than something else. I don't, where does that come from? Like, what is that all about? Maybe I think it goes back to, like, Victorian times, probably. And the class system and everything.
I was thinking about this last night, and I realised that my dad did a lot of bricklaying and plastering, and he did car repair at his school. But his school was like one of the top performing grammars in the area.
Yeah.
So looking like 60s or so, late 60s. But so this was a grammar school, so it was the academic centre of the town. And they did all of these kind of practical subjects. They did their bricklaying. They did car repair. So it's quite strange that what was considered to be perfectly standard in his grammar school, where every single student would have been academic, that's where that disconnect has come from at some point.
Yeah, I'll bring Chris. Well, I'll try and bring Chris in now. Chris, are you there? Are you with us?
I hope Chris? So. Yeah.
Hi, yes, good
morning.
Yeah,
good morning.
How are you doing this morning, okay?
Yeah, now I've sorted out the technology, yeah.
Oh, that's good news. We were just talking about bricklaying. I wondered whether you had any comments on that. It seems to be somebody with a chainsaw trying to chop the back of your head off, I can hear. But apart from that, what are your views on bricklaying?
I think anything we can give to our pupils that's going to help them in later life can only be a good thing. And it was something several years ago that we did have in education, and we seemed to provide something for everyone. And now the government seem to be forcing everybody down the same academic route without really considering that, you know, not all pupils are the same shape and have the same requirements.
Yeah. Karen, I'll come back to you a second just on what Chris has said. What do you think is the answer to this? You know, what's the answer to that in terms of this now? I mean, would you like to see the end, for example, of Progress 8 or Best 8 or Super 8? I mean, is that one answer? I mean, what do you want to do? What do you want to see happen?
Like removing Progress 8, the chance to, like, I don't think it's amazingly helpful, Progress 8. You know,
Well, I appreciate that we do need to measure things, but what if we remove something like that, chances are we'll just have it replaced with something else. It kind of needs a bigger long-term, but like really there's so many stakeholders involved that really we need a big sit down. The idea of getting in all of our different stakeholders, all of our different levels of education as well, because I think sometimes we don't have enough communication between our primaries and our secondaries, and then our secondaries and our colleges and sixth forms. And we're not always 100% certain what's going on in the different sectors of education. And then our understanding of kind of apprenticeships and the small little businesses that would be taking on these people. I think really we should be using coming out of the pandemic as an opportunity to sit down and almost have like a massive commission and get parents and students that have gone through the system. I'm quite happy to see some kind of like big overhaul, but I don't think that any of us have got all of the answers really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because if you overhaul, that means that teachers are going to have, you know, again, a huge workload implication to try and readjust to a new way of doing things. But then again, if it's a better way of doing things, then I guess it's worth it. But, you know, again, it would be a hard sell, I think, you know, especially with what's happened in the last year to change
things
now.
Yeah, I think that's kind of it's the way that change has gone about and as we've gone along as well, isn't it? So a lot of changes come without a huge amount of notice. If we were going to do something like a massive change, you kind of have to get a picture of where do we want to end up, where are we, and you need a kind of a longer term strategy from getting from A to B. The biggest problem with that is it takes longer than a political cycle.
Yeah.
So you really kind of need a plan that, because it always is going to come back down to the politicians will be making these decisions. So you really kind of need a consensus between Labour and Conservative. You'd actually need them to sit down, put aside their politics and come up with a plan that both are willing to keep to regardless of who takes power in so many years' time. And I think that's the biggest issue here is it requires our politicians to act like proper grown-ups and sit down and put aside interests. And that's not the way politics in this country works because of the adversarial nature of it all.
I'm not sure the politicians in France or other countries are any better, but yeah, I get you. I take your point. Chris, we'll bring you back in again. Do you think that Latin, this idea of bringing in more Latin, is a good idea?
No. Sure answer, no.
What are your views on all that?
Well, who is going to benefit from being taught Latin in schools? I've had people tell me actually it helps with English skills, but at the same time, you would ask the question: okay, well, there's a handful of pupils who will benefit from speaking Latin. How many pupils would benefit from more music and drama, or something like bricklaying, or plumbing, or you know, any practical skills that pupils are going to need later in life? In the grand scheme of things, we need to look at what we want to achieve from education in this country. What are we looking to do? Are we looking to produce pupils who will go on to contribute to society and be valuable members? Or are we just going to go through some academic tick box exercise for an inspection process to say, yes, this school is great because it fits in all the boxes and it does X, Y, and Z, when actually we need to look at what pupils need and put pupils at the centre of the curriculum planning and actually put things in place that is going to better pupils in the longer term. You know, if I'd have been taught Latin at school, would it have been any use to me? I'm not entirely sure it would. might come in useful now because we're going to have to find a million Latin teachers. But actually, when you think back to school, were we taught things that have benefited, you know, in later life? Well, yes, some of the stuff we were taught, we have found very useful in later life, but there will be an awful lot that we were taught at school that probably we don't even remember. So it's all about making sure that every pupil has a curriculum offer that is suitable for that pupil. And just because someone wants to tick a box to say you've got this amount and it goes back to your progress 8, you've got some of this and some of that, you can do your English and maths, you can do a little bit of humanities and you've got a modern foreign language, that's great. English and maths, everybody needs those skills. It's great to have a science background as well. But actually, do we need to be teaching every pupil every subject that they're required, you know, to do currently? Or do we need to look at making our curriculum something more suitable for individuals?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it, really? But I personally, I would like to see more vocational pathways, more vocational. I know we have vocational GCSEs, but I'm talking about much more a key stage 3 in the vocational side of things. Karen, we'll just bring you in to finish off. Karen, what are your thoughts, just to finish off on this? I mean, your final word on Latin and bricklaying.
I think the bricklaying is and those kind of vocational skills deserve the time and funding and attention a lot more than Latin, is my summary.
Thank you very much. Karen, Chris, it's been a pleasure. Hope to speak to you again soon. And yeah, hope to hear you again on Teachers Talk Radio.
Thank you very much.
Right, that was Chris and Karen talking about bricklaying and Latin, which is an interesting mix, isn't it? After the news, I'm going to be joined by my old friend Ed. And we're going to be talking about, well, we're talking about a range of things, actually, but most notably, his recent article for The Independent on decolonizing the curriculum. That's coming up in just a little bit.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News with Gail Glenn. In Scotland, the First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has announced that the wearing of face masks and social distancing in schools will remain for the first 6 weeks of the new academic year, which begins around the 16th of August. She stated that this also reflects the unique environment of schools, where large numbers of unvaccinated children and young people mix with adult staff. So for up to 6 weeks, subject then to review, there will be a continued requirement for staff to keep at least 1 metre distance from each other and from children and young people while on the school estate. She said, "We have also decided, after careful consideration, to retain the current requirements for face coverings in schools for staff and for children aged 12 or over. This includes asking young people and staff in secondary schools to wear face coverings during lessons and while inside school buildings." The First Minister also announced a further £10 million to local authorities to be allocated for improved ventilation and CO2 monitoring equipment in schools. In England, research carried out by Oxford Homeschooling using Department for Education data has monitored the largest increase and decreases in bullying exclusions between 2018-19 and 2019-20. Barking and Dagenham was the largest hotspot, showing a 200% increase in the number of suspensions and permanent exclusions from bullying. Figures were shown to more than double in 10 local authorities. Nationally across England, the data is more positive, and this is thought to be the result of school closures affecting the amount of time which students spent in contact with one another. The number of bullying exclusions fell by 31% in 2019-20. Greg Smith, head of operations at Oxford Homeschooling, said, "These new exclusion figures cover the whole of the 2019-20 school year. But with the final term being conducted during lockdown, it's interesting to see how the data compares to previous totals. In many ways, the measures introduced during the pandemic, like reduced class sizes and increased supervision, have helped address the country's bullying problem. So it will be interesting to see if schools try to adopt some of these permanently, even though restrictions are easing." This has been your daily education news briefing.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.cre8tiveresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. Introducing the Leadership Masterclass Series by Diana Osagie. Learn how to ditch your fears and develop your leadership confidence. How to deal with difficult colleagues. How to thrive when you lead in a challenging environment. And how to get colleagues to buy into your vision. Join Diana for her online leadership masterclasses, starting on the 10th of July and running all the way through the summer. These sessions are the perfect way to prepare and refresh for the next academic year and beyond. Book your place at courageousleadership.co.uk/events now. The first 50 leaders to sign up get an additional free mini coaching session with Diana herself. Don't miss this. Courageous Leadership Masterclasses at courageousleadership.co.uk/events.
Welcome back. I love the first half of the show talking about bricklaying in Latin. I'm now joined by Ed Durrell. Ed, how are you this morning?
Hello, hello. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you absolutely fine. What are you up to right now? Are you in London?
I am. Yeah. I'm in our office.
Happy days. You are a director of Public First. You're also an ex-deputy and news editor at the Times Educational Supplement, writing on education, politics, pubs and sport. Well, that's not what you're writing on. It just says that in your Twitter bio, but it would be cool if you were writing on those things. We have obviously worked together. When I was at the TES, I wrote a lot of blogs, and you were my amazing editor. He was very patient with my lack of grammatical skill. And incredible.
Your touch and go relationship with apostrophes.
100%. And if my mother was listening right now, she'd completely laugh her head off at that. But anyway, Ed, the reason that I've got you on the show today is to talk about your most recent article for The Independent, which came out 3 days ago. And the headline was, "People expect sensible debate about education, not inflammatory rows about decolonizing the curriculum." And it says in the sub here, "We should perhaps avoid complaining that there are, for example, too many, in quotes, dead white men in literature set text lists, and instead focus on making the canon bigger and more inclusive, not less." Now, in your article, you reference a survey or a questionnaire that was carried out by Public First, which is a think tank that you work for, a poll where less than a quarter of the public in England said that they supported the idea of decolonizing the curriculum. However, you brought to our attention some nuances within that data, within the article. So I was wondering whether you could maybe outline that for me in terms of what the main thrust of your article is.
So essentially what I was trying to say was that the general public, and I suppose for the sake of this radio show, let's call them parents, aren't interested in debates about the curriculum being drawn into the so-called culture war. And actually they have a kind of very broad-ranging and essentially centrist approach, neutral even, when it comes to such debates. There are people on both sides who would like school and university curricula to become a kind of battleground in this so-called culture war, shouting about, as I said, dead white men on the curriculum, or opposing people who want to broaden out the curriculum to include other cultures. But actually what our survey found was that while if you ask them directly about this phrase decolonizing the curriculum, they kind of, I suspect, in a knee-jerk way, said no. By, 3-1. But actually, if you ask them a much more gentle question about making the curriculum more broad, taking in other cultures, other writers, other people's histories, then they were overwhelmingly, even more overwhelmingly in favour of that.
And what was the percentage on that one? If it was 1 in 3?
It was something like 92% support.
Wow.
Making it bigger and more broad. Amazing. So what I don't think they want is, and obviously, I don't want teachers shouting at me. I know if you make the curriculum bigger in some ways, that makes life harder for teachers. This the great cliche of forcing more stuff on the curriculum being ridiculous. But what I think parents would like is the idea that you can still teach some of the kind of great, let's take English, for example, or history, your subject. You would still teach British history, and the key passages in our history, and not least of all, in my opinion, at least, for arguments of powerful knowledge and this kind of thing. But, they would also be very open to the idea of teaching more African history or Southeast Asian history, recognising that there are, other cultures and other histories that are equally valid. But what they don't want to be told is that we teach too much British history, and we shouldn't be so kind of closed-minded. They don't like being told that either. So this isn't a terribly good answer for.
But I suppose I suppose the counter to that is two things really: is space in the curriculum,
of course,
and also time to implement. So I guess sometimes there isn't a choice. It's either kind of decolonize the curriculum or don't, to use that phrase, decolonize the curriculum. You could use probably a number of other phrases, but decolonize that curriculum or don't. So if it came down to that choice, I mean, they're technically saying no, but you're saying that, hang on a minute, when they said no to that in the survey, it was specifically using that particular language of decolonize the curriculum, whereas you think that if you'd have used a different phraseology, that maybe more would have said, well, actually, no, we would choose that.
I think what I'm trying to say is that actually there was a way of updating and modernizing curricula to reflect the changing world. If you have it in a serious and nuanced and grown-up way, parents are, and the public are very open to that conversation. But they don't want it to be treated as a sort of divisive attack on what they would consider as their own culture.
Yeah. I mean...
I think that's right. I think, you know, I think it would be nice to be able to have a serious and grown-up conversation about, you know, whether there are too many... I don't like the phrase dead white men, but, you know, whether the English literature canon set texts, for example, are too British focused. That'd be an interesting conversation to have. But it's very hard to have in a kind of sober, sensible and considered way.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly enough, within your article, you also talk about an article that was done by one of your colleagues, James Frayne, where he talked about kind of like the English working class is much more liberal and open on subjects like ethnicity, gender and sexuality than many commentators, especially in the era of Brexit, might have us believe. I mean, what's the argument there? What's the basis of that? What evidence do we have for that?
Well, I mean, the point James makes, and I would say, having done hundreds and hundreds of focus groups in the last year, with the working class, people in areas you might characterise as the red wall, you know, there are a lot of people who assume because these areas voted overwhelmingly for Brexit, they are in some ways kind of racist or Neanderthal or, you know, backward looking. But actually on social issues, I think you find these working class people to be really very liberal, you know. And the evidence supports this, you know, white working class people in England overwhelmingly support gay marriage. They overwhelmingly say they would be happy if their child married, you know, interracially. They aren't as often characterised by kind of what you might characterise as liberal kind of liberal media. They voted for Brexit because.
Well, why did they vote for Brexit? You tell me the answer to that one.
Huge generalisation, but
because they didn't they? Let's be honest about that.
You know, Stockton and Redcar and Doncaster and Oldham, and you know, these places are overwhelmingly voted for Brexit. And I would argue it was an economic kind of cry for help. You know. The reason that the Remain campaign's arguments fell on deaf ears was because if you're told that there'll be an economic disaster if you leave the European Union, well, if frankly you live in Blyth and you've been out of work for 30 years and you've seen the industry collapse around you and everything on the high street shut, you know, being told there will be an economic crisis if you leave. It's a bit of a joke because they've been living in an economic crisis for 30 or 40 years. So it was a sort of roll. It was almost like a last roll of the dice. It's like something has to change. We'll be giving a chance to change something. We'll change this then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. It absolutely does. Now, just coming back to your article again, just further down here, it says, There is a line to be walked. We should perhaps avoid complaining that there are, for example, too many dead white men in literature set texts and instead focus on making the canon bigger and more inclusive, not less. The British public evidently believe that young people should learn about cultures other than their own, but they also like traditional subjects and traditional works of literature. So again, you're talking really about this balance, aren't you, between the two. Now, do you think that debate in politics and education around these issues has become very polarized and is very polarized? You know, do you find that that balance is coming through? And who do you think the voices presenting that balance are? Because I'm, you know, I don't know where they are. So who are they?
Me. No, I really don't think there are. I think that's one of the problems. And this is something I imagine your listeners will sympathize with, but which is, you know, this is a classic example.
Ed, can you do me a favor and just go a bit close to the receiver?
Sorry, is that better?
That's a bit better. And also, if you can stay still as well, because there's like a little clicky sound. I don't know what it is, but maybe it's moving the headphones or something. I don't know. That's better. That's better.
Okay. You know, classic example of education being used as a political battleground. You know.
Yeah.
And it's very easy if you're not a teacher to say, well, we should just make the curriculum bigger, or, you know, the canon larger, or, you know, get rid of Dickens. But actually, you know, obviously, if you're a teacher teaching it, that's a different thing altogether. Now, I wish, and the voices are absent, that we could have a national conversation that wasn't kind of knee-jerk and polarized, because I think it's an important conversation to be had. I would emphasize the fact I think it is a national conversation, and this is something perhaps your listeners might be less keen on. And I think perhaps we talked about last time I was on your show, was the fact that I do think curriculum, not pedagogy, but curriculum is a political issue, and it is a national conversation. And while, you know, teachers should definitely inform it and be the experts in how stuff works in sequencing terms, for example, you know, there can't be anything really, I struggle to think of anything more political in a good way than what we should be teaching our kids. And if you have a national curriculum, then that should be a national debate.
Yeah, just coming back, I don't know if you heard any of the first part of my show.
Yeah, I heard some of it.
Yeah, but, you know, talking of curriculum then, in terms of what should be taught, what do you think of the whole Latin thing? What are your views on that?
Oh, well, I think it's a sort of red herring, isn't it, really? A board policy advisor in the department threw a bone out just to see how it would land. But I could be wrong. But I think you've been following the world of education as long as me, Tom. I think this is like the fifth time I've seen this story. Yeah. The sixth time I've seen the story. You know, more Latin or universal Latin teaching is like a kind of absolutely kind of standard silly season story, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and £5 million, or was it £5 million they said they'd commit to?
I don't know, something like that.
I mean, it might, obviously, it would be a lot of money for you or me, but in the grand scheme.
How do you know?
I've known you long enough. you know, in the grand scheme of the education system, is literally peanuts. I mean, it's not, you know, change from the back of the sofa. It's so
true.
You know, it's what, two secondary schools worth of money?
Yeah.
You know, it's minuscule, and the teaching Latin thing is really interesting, isn't it? It's that sort of the reason it works as a political argument is because, you know, there is this never-ending kind of idea that somehow independent schools know better how to teach kids, which is obviously bollocks. And Latin sort of represents the kind of the top of that conversation, doesn't it? It's like, you know, posh kids learn Latin at independent school. Therefore, if we want to make our schools better, we're going to get kids in working class comps to learn Latin too. It's a really weird story. I mean, actually, there is an argument, isn't there? And I'm sure, in fact, I heard some of it being rehearsed earlier on the show. There is an argument vaguely in favour of Latin, and it helps other languages develop. You know, once you've learnt Latin, it's much easier to learn French.
That's the one I kind of highlighted.
Romance languages, which I'm sure is true, but I mean, the entire exam system is being burnt to the ground. You know, it's like, It's just like so little significance.
Ed, I feel like I shouldn't have started talking about Latin because someone's just started smashing bottles everywhere. I feel like that's triggered
the trouble with doing this from my office.
That's triggered a response. Everyone's chucking glasses everywhere. do you think, like, in terms of Gavin Williamson, I mean, is his thing with, I mean, is that a personal thing with Latin for him? I mean, is that, or is this someone who's told him that? I mean, I don't know if you saw that thread from Amy Gibbons yesterday. Yes. Talking about Gavin Williamson basically not being involved in anything, basically being loads of decisions being made without his say-so, essentially, was what I was picking up from there. So is this something he believes in, or is this something that other people believe in?
I think lots of people believe in it.
I guess I'm asking where the idea is coming from. I mean, who's driving it?
I think, frankly, it's just, as I say, you know, it's dusting down a policy that they've rolled out, or not even a policy, a press release that they've rolled out 5 or 6 times in the last 15 years. I don't know where it comes from. I mean, on balance, would I like to see more Latin in schools? Yeah, probably a bit more. I think it wouldn't be bad. I think it would help people learn one foreign languages. I don't think it's a terrible idea. Would I like to see a better vocational education system? Yes, a lot more than a bit more Latin. You know, it just seems like the priorities are all wrong there, really.
100%. That's my opinion. I mean, I put a tweet out the other week about bricklaying. It was like a few days ago. Basically, like, I'd love to see a bit more of that. You know, it's just, I don't get it. And I get the argument of, look, it costs money, you need the provision, you need the setup and everything. But if that, you just mentioned £5.5 million for Latin, which is a drop in the ocean, but actually £5.5 million could at least fund spaces for vocational work, or it could fund, you know, there's quite a long, that would go a long way in some contexts in terms of just setting up spaces and facilitating a little bit more in terms of the idea of having more vocational subjects. You know, I don't know.
You're right. There may be better ways of spending the money. Did you learn any Latin at school, Tom?
I actually did. I had to do it. I went to a state school, but I had to do it in year 7? I think I did it in year 7.
Yeah, me too. I did it for 1 year.
Yeah, year 7. And,
Was it the Cambridge Latin course? Do you remember that one?
I cannot remember what it was. I remember that we had to learn Parnis Angelicus I can't remember the next bit, but we had to learn that and sing it together.
A famous course that I remember it was called the Cambridge Latin course, and it was all based around a family that lived in Pompeii, and the dad was called Caecilius, and I tweeted Caecilius est in horto laborat, which obviously means Caecilius is in the garden working, when the story broke. And it got this whole long debate about whether this Cambridge Latin course was any good or not. Classicists coming back and saying that it was a terrible way of teaching Latin, that it did more damage to Latin education than anything else.
Tom Hopkinsburg has just texted in saying there shouldn't be an est in there.
Yeah, wow. That's right.
He's the expert. I'm not. I don't have a clue. I just remember being sat in those Latin lessons next to all these lads who, honestly, you wouldn't think they'd be. It was a little bit like Barney from The Simpsons. You're like, doing this Latin. And I was one of them, to be honest with you, thinking, what the bloody hell's going on here? But yeah, it was fun. It was fun at the time. Anyway, Ed, it's always a pleasure. You take care now.
Enjoy.
Yeah, yeah, I'll speak to you soon again.
All right,
cheers, mate. Take care. See you later. Bye. That was Ed Dorrell, who is a director at Public. Oh, is it Public Fair? Oh, God. I don't know. He's the director at a think tank in London who do lots and lots of interesting polls. And one of them, as we mentioned, was on decolonizing the curriculum. And it was interesting what he was saying there, because he was saying that even though a lot of people who were surveyed actually turned around and said no to the idea, but then he was saying that once you dug a bit deeper, they were actually yes. It was just maybe the use of language and this kind of culture war element to it that people want to avoid and people don't want to, you know, they don't respond well to. And perhaps it's the language, because once you ask them actually in a different way, they were in favour. I think he said 92% were in favour of broadening the curriculum. So they're really high numbers, you know. So, yeah, interesting. And then, obviously, the entire show, the thread running through the show is Latin. Lots of interesting opinions on that too. Thanks very much for joining me this morning on the morning break. We've got loads of shows coming up on Teachers Talk Radio over the next few days. Goodness me. We've got Seb Ventura later on for the drive home. I'm not sure what Seb's he's not here, so I don't know what Seb's topic is, but it's always interesting and always entertaining. We've got Genevieve Bent for the late show at 8 p.m. I know she's got Rhea Gibbs as a guest at 8 p.m. on her show tomorrow morning. Pooja Agarwal is the special guest with Kate Jones at 9 a.m. tomorrow on the drive home. That'd be a strange time to drive home, unless you're doing a night shift of teaching. And then we've got Dorian Brown at 11 a.m. On the morning break, as usual. And Krishna Sanal, who is on the late show at 8 p.m. tomorrow. So goodness me, a lot of shows coming up over the next 48 hours. And I highly recommend listening back to Lizzie's show from this morning. Lizzie made her debut on Teachers Talk Radio this morning on The Breakfast Show. Fantastic guest talking about education research. Make sure you catch that on the website. Listen back to it. It was super.
Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
That's it for the morning break this morning. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in and joining me live. And if you have just listened back to this as a podcast, thank you to you too. We've just reached 6,000 followers on Twitter, which is remarkable considering Teachers Talk Radio has only existed for maybe 5 months now. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for your support. Keep involved, subscribe on the website, and listen for more Teachers Talk Radio at ttradio.org.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.